Believe it or not, yesterday was the 101st anniversary of the 1916 Rising, and it passed with little fanfare. Fresh from a year of being bombarded with information about the 1916 Rising, the question arises, what do we know about the Seven Signatories beyond their seemingly unswerving resolve to break the grip of imperialism in Ireland? In his iconic Easter 1916, Yeats eulogises Pearse with the line, "That man had kept a school." Well, thanks largely to the Pearse Museum in Rathfarnham, we remember much about St. Enda's. But how much do we really know about Pearse's pedagogy? Well, I'm joined in studio by UCD lecturer in Irish history, Dr. Conor Mulva, to talk about the lesser spotted moment in Pearse's life, his interest in Belgium, and how he went on tour there. Conor,
morning,
he travelled. He travelled to the Low Countries.
He did indeed. He travelled to more than that. But I think there was a particular influence of 2 months that he spent in Belgium in 1905. He went over there, and at the time, this is, I suppose, before really true glimmer of revolution was in Pearse's eyes, or certainly before he had any kind of working strategy documents. He was 25 years old, a UCD graduate, and he was there initially as part of a Gaelic League delegation. And at the time, he was editor of On Clive Sullis, The Sword of Light, of which he was editor between 1903 and 1909.
What did he see in the Belgian school system that so impressed him?
Oh, absolutely. So he went over, first of all, in this Fontenoy committee. It was kind of a Gaelic League thing to go on commemoration over there. And he stayed on, and he went visiting schools. He had letters of introduction from various people. One of the really important ones was from Dr. William Starkey, the resident commissioner of national education in Dublin. And he was actually one of the few sympathetic supporters of Pearse's educational ideas within the kind of Dublin Castle circle. So armed with these letters, he goes across and he inspects schools over the course of almost 2 months.
Now, his observation, only the Irish-speaking peasant of Connemara or Munster is more essentially Catholic than the Flemish peasant of Flanders or the Brabant.
Yes. So Pearse comes back from Belgium, and he writes a series of, actually it runs to at least 33 articles that I've identified in An Clive Sullis, which I must say is now digitised thanks to Conor na Gaeilge. So anyone can go and look at all that run of An Clive Sullis online. But anyway, what he has in these articles, you know, a few interesting themes. One of them is an interesting insight into Pearse's view of history. We see this idea of a kind of the deified Catholic peasant, which is atypical of many of the other 1916 leaders. And then he also, you know, makes comments which I think are indicative, maybe in a sort of a retrospective way, of how he's thinking later. As in every country in which there has been a national revival, poets and dreamers had to prepare the way for men of action. So he sees himself maybe as a hybrid breed between those two.
So when you look at that in 1905 or whatever it was, I mean, it's anticipating.
Well, yeah, or else it just looked like a kind of a literary flourish in the paper. Yeah.
Now, who was Henri Conscience?
This guy is very interesting, and I must admit, an apology to any Belgians listening, I knew nothing about Henri Conscience before I read about him in Patrick Pearse's writings. This is one of the famous figures in Flemish literature. Henri Conscience had been born of a Belgian mother and a French father who was actually an artillery officer, as far as my understanding goes. So I believe that Pearse drew a lot of comparisons between Conscience and himself, because Pearse, obviously with his English father, all that stuff, seems to have spent a lot of his younger years almost trying to compensate for this idea that he was half English, which he, in a personal sense, seems to have reacted against. So what Conscience does is he goes and he writes prolifically for much of his life, and he almost kind of fills out the corpus of Flemish literature. So when Pearse is learning about Conscience and then thinking about the Belgian model and applying it to Ireland, what he's thinking is, if I can go back and just write a corpus of Irish literature that we don't really have, modern Irish literature, I can save the language.
He had a number of things to say about various aspects of teaching, gender roles in the classroom, for example.
So one thing that I think really comes across strongly in these articles is Pearse's admiration for women in work, and particularly for female teachers. He talks about the intuitive method of language education, and he says that this relies upon the maternal instinct. Now, that's not necessarily female, but it does obviously have a gender aspect to it. And I think one of the things he's saying here in that fluid period before the First World War is that even men teaching the classroom should assume something of a maternal instinct when teaching children.
I mean, he lays
children
down the kind of spec for the teacher, if you like.
Oh, absolutely.
Infinite sympathy, infinite tact, infinite patience, and an intimate understanding of the child mind and the capacity to come down to its level, an attractive and winning manner, and finally considerable talents as a draftsman, a mimic, and a raconteur.
No pressure, Patrick.
Yeah. No pressure.
if I think if anyone teaching, myself included, could get half of that into the classroom, we'd be doing very well. It's interesting about this draftsman thing, though, because one of the things that Pearce sees in Belgium that has nothing to do with language education as such is this idea of l'image animée. This is where teachers will begin a sort of a module of language learning with a blank blackboard. And they'll say, in his case, he was looking at bilingual classrooms. So these are children of about 7, half speaking Flemish, half speaking French. And the teacher will speak in Flemish one day and French the next, and will rely upon the native speakers in the classroom. But she might say, OK, we're going to learn over the next few weeks everything about the sea and maritime affairs. She'll start by drawing a boat, and they'll say, what's this? And the French child says, c'est un bateau. I don't speak Flemish, but you know, they'll do that in Flemish. So the children are learning bilingually in an organic sense from the start. And then she'll draw the sea and she'll say, what's in the sea? And she relies upon the children's imagination. The fluent speakers help the non-fluent speakers.
I mean, that requires a talented teacher.
Oh, absolutely,
doesn't it?
Absolutely. But I think Pearce really saw that level of talent. There was one teacher called Madame de Padua, who he names in his articles as being his idealised teacher. He said she was just incredible at teaching.
Now, he also was aware overcrowding the classroom was a problem in Ireland.
Yeah.
He insisted that there should be kindness in the classroom, corporal punishment. corporal punishment.
Yeah.
And then things like the methods of teaching, which were much more sophisticated, it appears, in Belgium than they were here.
Absolutely. But also, I think these are things that the Gaelic League is really thinking about and talking about. We have, in some senses, now I'm not talking about the Gaelic League, but about the Irish education system more generally, a fossilised sense of how Irish language learning happened after 1922. We think about the early Department of Education, compulsory Irish, and I'm, you know, I take a punt on the fact that I'm sure many of the listeners listening will have that experience of leaving the public education system with a hatred of the Irish language, you know, without mixing my words. What Pearce is advocating here, among other things, is the direct method, which is essentially like anyone who would have learned the Berlitz method of learning any language today. This came from a guy called Berlitz who, far as my memory serves, went over to the United States, wanted to set up a school for learning languages, and he brought in a foreign teacher. But when the teacher got there, he realised the teacher didn't speak English, so they had to just teach through the language. Mm. And he actually found that this works rather well. So Pearce, from his Belgian experience, says this direct method, teaching through the language and not through translation, is the way to go. Yeah.
Now, he obviously wrote in the Clive Sulish when he came back, but he also wrote a pamphlet, was it called The Murder Machine?
Murder Machine.
Now, people might think that's to do with the rebellion, the Brits and all the rest, but what was it about?
This is a very subtle, carefully considered and erudite treatise on education. And it goes beyond language learning, okay? The Murder Machine as a study in pedagogy really is about how the idealised form of education would be. Rereading this over the last few years, I taught a class which used this as one of its readings, so I read it about once a year, which, you know, is a bit sad, but one of the things he has in this is he applies the concept of ancient Irish fosterage. So he reads back into the days of Cullen, and he realised that whereas other European monarchical families would marry off their daughters and sons in order to create alliances, what was done in the ancient Irish system was boys predominantly were fostered between families, so that there wasn't, you know, any of those animosities that might come between in-laws and outlaws and all those things, but instead that there would be a bond of brothers that would just more loosely cement clans and tribes. And he saw this as a way of dispelling conflict.
Now, it's one thing to write about it and advocate it. Did he implement it at St. Enda's?
I would say, I suppose, doing a report card on St. Enda's, that he certainly did. This idea of fosterage he takes, and he does it almost on kind of a universal level. He brings boys in St. Enda's as boarders and girls in St. Edith's in from totally different backgrounds. If you look at the population of St. Enda's, famous Irish families, either subsequently or before that, the Gwynns, the Bulfins, you know, these are major families from very different backgrounds, Catholics, Protestants. There were also foreign students in St. Enda's. And by this, he's creating that. One of the things that Pearce is credited for, and I wonder whether this is 100% accurate, is that apparently in St. Enda's he introduced the nature table as a concept. But it is something that he writes about, having seen in Belgium, bringing children out into the outdoors, getting them involved in manual labour, working on hand-eye skills while simultaneously teaching languages or the classics or anything else.
It's a pity some of the Department of Education officials in the early 1920s didn't follow him to Belgium and pick up a few tricks.
Absolutely, yeah. And this is the thing. I think we see in pre-First World War Ireland and in that really dynamic phase of the Gaelic League, a vision for a really innovative education system in Ireland. Now, the education system did very well. It got people, you know, their 3 R's in the 1920s. Yeah. And
we had to come from a very low base.
From a low base point. But this is a vision of a completely different kind of education. I think Pearce sums it up well. He writes in The Murder Machine, "We need the divine breath of that moves through free peoples, the breath that no man of Ireland has felt in his nostrils for many centuries, that kindles, as wine kindles, the hearts of those who taught and learned at Clonmacnoise." But I think he sums this up better in his much lesser spotted Belgian articles in An Clive Sullis, where he says that the best we have is not too good in the service of our children.
Dr. Conor Mulvihill, UCD lecturer in Irish history, thank you very much for joining us.